Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you are listening to the webcast version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Sarah Morrison. She's a computational astrophysicist here at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
So, Sarah, you're a computational astrophysicist, and most people think of astronomers, and they think back in the old days, they looked through telescopes. Of course, it's much more complicated than that. But your work is outside the box of what many people think of anyway when it comes to astronomy. So talk about how the work that you and your colleagues do amplifies the understanding of the astronomical systems.
Yeah, so when you're looking through a telescope, one, you know, a lot of times we're being able to look at many, many systems at once now. We have not just, you know, one observation of a planet around another star, we have many of them. And so you need to be able to have developed techniques for handling large amounts of observations and also interpreting what you're seeing out of large numbers of observations. And so having computational experience really lends itself to that.
So for example, when people look at a system and they see something, back in the day perhaps, would they have been limited in their understanding? In other words, they might have. Is it possible they would have seen something and say, we're cataloging this, but we really don't have a way to probe what is actually happening, and now they could probe that? Is that possible by running models?
Yes, and actually we're now in the era where we're sort of still very much in the discovery phase of discovering planets around other stars. So we now know of, you know, several thousands of those, but we haven't had even the capability to be able to detect planets around other stars except about, you know, 20 years ago or so. So it's actually a fairly recent technological development.
And so would you say the computational work needs to catch up, or what kinds of work needs to be done? I mean, it seems like there's a whole slew of things, such as populations, what populations you could expect, all kinds of things. Talk a little bit about sort of the different sorts of things people are trying to find out.
Yeah, so I mean, there's been a lot of theoretical work that has gone into understanding how planets formed for a long time because we had our solar system as an example. But as we've discovered other exoplanet systems, that has really also drive the computational side. So I would say it's actually a bit of both development going on right now, because on the computational side, it is still very computationally intensive to be able to model how planets form inside computers. And from an observational perspective, we can't observe this process in real time necessarily. So I would say that there's a lot of back and forth still going on in terms of observations and the theoretical development as well.
Fair enough. That's what I would think. You have students that you're working with and your own training and your own background. So what kinds of things did you have to learn that most people wouldn't think of when they think about astronomers? The kinds of things, the tools that you had to sharpen, so to speak, to become adept at what you do?
Well, my expertise is in orbital dynamics, which is at its core very, very mathy. So, as an undergraduate, I took upper-level math courses throughout my undergraduate. And as far as on the computational side, I learned a lot of the computational techniques actually, quote unquote, on the job. But I would say that's becoming increasingly not as common anymore. Like, you have to be able to, take more programming courses, but then be able to apply what you learn in those courses in these different contexts. So I would say actually, even since I've been in school, which was not that long ago, there's even been a change.
So talk a little bit about, for example, if you talk to students or in your own career as a scientist, how do you keep the big picture in front of you so that you don't get just sidetracked by all the tiny little details that you have to chase down?
So sometimes it can be really tricky because you want to make sure that you are, you know, calculating the right answer, or you're using techniques that will, you know, you're modeling it to the best of your ability so that you can get a close, so that you can get as close to the answer as possible. And sometimes in that process, the temptation is to really chase down, you know, the nitty gritty details. So there is definitely a balance that goes on with that. And I think a lot of that, it's with experience often that being able to juggle that comes in.
Right. Sure. That makes sense. When you have to sell a student, so usually anytime you write a paper, anytime you write a grant, you're always thinking about audience. So if you've got a student and you need to sell a student on going into this field and keeping them intellectually excited, as it were, do you focus on the picture of the astronomy piece of it? Do you talk about the programming that they're going to do? How do you kind of capture them, so to speak? Fish for students, maybe.
Yes. I try to do a mixture of both, where showing some of the nitty-gritty detail of what actually goes into doing calculations like this, but also constantly putting that in context, in the bigger context of, well, what is it that we're trying to find here? You know, what are the broad questions that we're trying to answer with this, you know, very nitty-gritty, complicated calculation?
The reason I ask is that I was a department head for many, many years, and in a physics department that's coupled with astronomy, as I've been in all of my career, we've often found that astronomy really acts as a lure, as it were. Students are so interested in it. It's very exciting to them. And it isn't always clear. It's partly because of this sort of thing where you look up at the sky and it just blows you away. So in your own mind, in your own career, how much of a part of that does that still play, where you're saying to yourself, this is fascinating because of the subject matter itself? Or do you sometimes find that you're just in the weeds because you have so much stuff you have to take care of?
Well, I actually, you know, I got into this field for a reason. I really like that it constantly puts Earth in perspective, at least what I do, because since I study how planets form, I'm always a lot of times trying to connect what I do back to understanding our solar system and understanding Earth more. So for me, there's still very much the thrill of discovery, even though, of course, trying to debug everything, you know, you have your days where you...
Sure.
Have that happen.
Well, we have that happen in the lab all the time when we're sitting trying to make a pump not burn itself up while it's trying to pump out a chamber. So I understand very much it's hard sometimes to keep that separate. So now that you mentioned that, give a name to what you do. You said planetary dynamicist or something along those lines. Talk about the nitty-gritty of how you work and what kind of a system you might look at. Give an example or something like that.
Yeah, so I'm a planetary dynamicist, so I study the motions of objects and from that figure out something about their history. So for example, one of the projects I'm working on right now, we're modeling planetary embryos inside of a computer and having them collide and merge as they would in the disk that they're forming out of. And then we're trying to see what you get out of that process and how that compares to actual observed planetary systems, particularly planetary systems that contain the most common kinds of planets.
So just out of curiosity, what would you start with? Is it just a big ball of gas, or how far back do you go?
Well, so that can get tricky because, you know, the further back you go, the more physics often you have to include. So for these particular kinds of simulations, we start with planets having already formed to be about a mass of the moon, but you have, you know, a disk of hundreds of them potentially around the star that they're forming out of. So we're talking about a little bit later stage than the actual star forming.
And if you did that and you started the program essentially from similar constraints and ran it two different times or many different times, are you going to get crazily different results, or are you going to get sort of similar results?
So it depends on the kind of process. If you're modeling the exact same initial conditions, you should get the exact same
thing out
if your computer code is working as it should.
Right.
But it turns out, particularly as planets are growing, that process can be fairly chaotic. So even if you change your initial conditions sometimes slightly, you can get sometimes very different results in that context. But if you have the same exact initial conditions,
I get it. You
should get the same results.
But that means that since we don't know the true initial conditions that well, then there's, let's call it, a wide array of things that we could see.
Exactly. That right? And that's actually what we're trying to quantify, is what that wide array would be given the initial conditions that you're starting with, actually being able to quantify that.
So is that some sort of a population distribution of
yes.
some kind or another?
Yes.
What, based on mass or location or what kinds of things?
It depends a lot of times. So in our case, we're looking at what kinds of orbit distributions we have in multi-planet systems that had planetary embryos colliding and merging, but not moving around very much in the disk they were forming out of in terms of the distance that they formed from relative to the star. So yes, it's a population synthesis, and we're, you know, looking at the resulting orbit distributions, what kinds of resulting planet masses you get after they've grown and merged, and mm-hmm. how those compare to actual observed multi-planet
systems. So would this be applicable to something like, what is that system that's got so many of the planets? Is that the TRAPPIST system? Would this make one of those then?
So in particular, right now, we're modeling conditions for solar-type stars.
Oh, for solar-type
stars. So TRAPPIST-1, I think, is a system you're thinking of, is a lower-mass star.
Okay.
But there actually is a lot of interest in trying to figure out whether planetary systems that form super-Earths, which are what we're trying to model, if that process is similar between solar-type stars and M-dwarfs. Okay. So that is actually something that we'll probably be doing in the future.
I know you're interested also in this famous Goldilocks stuff. So talk a little bit about that whole thing, Goldilocks and the habitable zone.
Yeah. So the habitable zone traditionally is defined as if you have a planet that is that has an Earth-like atmosphere, what distance would it need to be from its star in order to have the right temperature on its surface to have liquid water? And that does have a lot of assumptions associated with it, particularly that, you know, the planet started out with an Earth-like atmosphere. So some of the things we're looking at are, you know, what are some other effects that can play a role on the habitability of a planet, particularly in these multi-planet systems, some of which are very compact systems with planets that are orbiting fairly close to one another. Actually, as an example, like TRAPPIST-1, like you mentioned, falls into this category.
Just out of curiosity, when you run models like this and when you're doing this kind of work, do you really hope and want a lot more of observational data to come in so that it can then be used to help confirm and amplify what you're doing? Is that very important?
Yeah, of course. I mean, so one of the benefits of being able to model planetary systems inside a computer is that you can turn on and off little bits of physics to figure out what is important in driving, you know, why does a planet end up a certain mass or something like that. So, you know, that's something you can do inside of a computer, but we want actual systems to be able to compare, you know, to those experiments you can run inside of a computer for planets forming. So definitely, you know, always having more observational data helps us understand more of what the underlying physics could be.
I'm going to ask you about a particular one because I was talking to one of your students and she mentioned something that I thought was interesting and I had never really heard about it. So when I think about this from a very stupid, I'm a condensed matter physicist sort of viewpoint, I think, okay, you've got all this mass in this disk. It makes these protoplanets and then they make planets, okay. But she talked about something called a galactic tide. I think that's what she talked about. What is that? What does something like that mean? Does that mean that there's bigger effects here from just our being in a galaxy? Is that possible? I don't understand that.
Yeah. So depending on the problem that you're interested in, of course, you know, sometimes these effects play more of a role. So she was likely discussing the tide that the Milky Way galaxy has on planetary systems. So if you're trying to calculate the trajectory of a comet that's orbiting in the very distant parts of our solar system, for example, you actually do need to take into account the mass of the rest of the effects that the rest of the galaxy has on the motion of that comet, for example.
What kind of percentage? I mean, do you have a ballpark? How much could this affect things dramatically? I mean,
well, it depends on the, like, if you're trying to model the motion of Earth around the sun, you don't need to worry about it.
Right.
But if you're trying to model, say, how an object in the Oort cloud that is very, very distant, that's even, you know, further beyond Pluto, you know, in our solar system, then it would play more of an important role. So it sort of depends on what kind of physical scenario you're interested in, and whether or not that effect could be important. Of course, you could include the effect if you're trying to simulate Earth's motion around the sun. It just won't have as much of a contribution.
Right.
But it is something you can quantify and test, of course, and we do.
So when you say turn effects off and on in your models, you're thinking of those sorts of things, except more important ones for the stuff you're doing.
Yes. So, for example, you know, if you have planets that are forming in the disk around their star, you know, if they're forming around the time when the disk is still fairly massive, you can have effects where the disk itself is influencing the orbit of the embryo as it's growing. And so it may form further out from its star and then migrate in. So the orbit itself is changing because of the disk that it's forming out of.
Okay.
But if you have planets that form later, you may not necessarily need to take that into account because a lot of times the disk at that stage is mostly gone away.
Mostly gone away. So just out of curiosity, are the two primary mechanisms, are they accretion and gravitational? I mean, how do these things do? They bump into each other or one of them grabs the other one? By gravity, how do the things grow?
Well, when they bump into each other, a lot of times they are being influenced by gravity in
sure,
that process.
Right.
So
that
it's actually
sense.
That you're – a lot of times you're able to self-consistently model collisions in that sense where, you know, one object is pulled in
right.
due to the mutual gravity
right.
of another. A lot of times when it comes to the actual collision process itself, that can be very computationally intensive if you're trying to model something not as a perfect collision. So a lot of times in these, sometimes they assume sort of a perfect collision where you don't necessarily have fragments that result.
Right.
So that's actually still a very open area of research on a computational side of things.
So people try to tweak the code to take into account more complicated collisions and then what?
Yes.
See if the outcome looks more like some things that you could observe or something like that?
Yes, because, I mean, so there are trade-offs, of course, because if you include more complicated collisions, it increases the runtime of your simulations a lot.
Right,
but
right.
at the same time, it is more physically realistic. So there are pros and cons to including more physics. You, of course, want it to be as realistic as you can, but at the same time, you want to be able to run the simulations in a feasible way. So there is always this trade-off.
When you say feasible, some of your simulations take as long as blank to run?
Yeah, so you know sometimes they can take a month or more to run
on
a lot of processors.
Is that on a desktop computer or is that on
a
fancy-schmancy computer?
That would be on a fancy-schmancy computer. You can run sometimes these individual simulations on a laptop computer, but keep in mind that when we're trying to build these large population synthesis models, you're simulating thousands of systems. And so even though you could do an individual simulation on your laptop computer, if you're really trying to get this, get thousands of systems modeled, that would take a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
So often they use special computational facilities.
Great. Now, one of the things we'll end up on is the fact that you've been a faculty member now for a relatively short amount of time. You're starting to get your feet wet and figure things out. Have you started to form any impressions about the things, about the preconceived notions? I mean, I know you've taught some in the past also. So have you started to get a feel for preconceived notions students bring to something like physics and astronomy? I'm just curious about how you think students look at it. Do they have preconceived notions? You're teaching an intro astronomy class, for example, now. What have you been finding out?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's usually a lot of interest generally in astronomy, even if you're not planning to go into the field. I think that sometimes, you know, students have sometimes had not so great experiences with math in the past. And a lot of physics and astronomy is math, but I always try to teach it in a way that it is okay to struggle with it and learn from it, because everyone at the end of the day can actually do math. It's more trying to find the right environment and right setting that works for you in order to do it. And that's ultimately what I have found that works.
That's great. Well, Sarah, thanks so much for stopping by and talking about this. It's fascinating. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And this is Dave Cornelison for the webcast version of STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.